conflict between what is, which is anger arising, and what I think should be. I shouldn't be angry. Or I have a violent thought. I'd like to strangle a certain politician. And then I think, oh no, I shouldn't. I should be compassionate. And then all that. And then it's the ego all the time, which is in an internal conflict between what is and what I think should be. Okay? What actually would be more realistic, instead of saying, I am angry, is to say, anger is arising. Anger is arising. And then if I pay attention to anger, a very interesting thing happens. What I find is, I don't mean only anger, I mean, I'm talking about any strong emotion. It could be fear, you know, or envy or whatever. Let's say anger. Anger is arising. If I said anger is arising, I could pay attention to the sensations of anger in the body. I would find a certain clench here, or a certain tightness here, or a certain pallor or redness in the face, or something or other, but I'd feel it as an energetic movement in the body. That's what is. And it's the ego, you see, because of its conditioning, that says what is somehow, I don't like what is, what should be is better. So what you've got here is the conditioned mind, how we've been conditioned, interacting with reality, with a capital R. Okay? And then, of course, we have all kinds of ego ideals. You know, I shouldn't be angry, I shouldn't be violent, based on whatever our values is. So egos are always frustrated. There is no ego that doesn't experience frustration. And we're driven by this kind of conditioning all the time. Then all egos are insecure. All egos, in the sense that everybody has death anxiety. Everybody is frightened of dying. So what I'm trying to do is to suggest that one way we can be compassionate towards other egos is by understanding the fragility of the ego. That the ego, or the personal sense of self, the smaller self, is profoundly vulnerable. It's subject to all this anxiety about death, about survival, and it's subject to all the things that have been poured into us from childhood, all this conditioning about who we are and who we're supposed to be and all that kind of thing. So conflict is inherent in the ego, or in the sense of self. And the other problem is that every ego, by definition, is separate from every other ego. We all, at the level of the ego, at the tip of the wave, we all feel separate. Well, another comment of Krishnamurti is that where there's separation, eventually there's conflict. If you're going to have separation, at some point you're going to have conflict. If you don't accept the way things are, if you don't accept what is, and you escape into what I think should be, you'll produce internal conflict in yourself as well. So I think it's the ego's fragility that makes the ego dangerous. It's our sense of isolation and the fact that we're not aware that we are actually aspects of the totality. If you realize that you are part of the totality, you won't do any damage. The answer to the problem of evil from this point of view is to understand the nature of reality. If you understand that you and other people and the earth are a unity, are a totality, why would you do any harm? You wouldn't do any harm because you are that. That's the famous Upanishadic saying, thou art that, tattvam asi, is talking about this sense that we are actually the totality. See, the whole thing has been a big historical mistake. In the ego is not an entity. It isn't a little person in the skull. It's just treated as if it is by a historical accident. Briefly, what happened was Freud postulated the existence of an ego. He says that. I looked it up. I actually went back and looked it up. He says it's a postulate. There's a whole set of functions that are what we call ego functions: control of body movement, control of instinctual drives like sexuality and aggression, judgment, perception, memory, the capacity to regulate tension, to think symbolically, organize yourself, defend against anxiety, test reality. These are all things that what we the psychologists call ego functions. Well, all those functions are going on. Clearly, it would be absurd to say those things are not going on. They're all going on. The problem is when you postulate an entity which is doing all that. You don't need to do that. You see, Descartes made the same mistake. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. Well, if it's raining outside, there doesn't have to be a rainer that's doing the raining. It's just raining. Okay? So that thinking can go on, feeling can go on, imagining can go on, reality testing can go on. There doesn't have to be an ego entity that's doing all that. These things simply arise. That was Descartes' logical error. He assumed, as I think Freud did, he assumed what needs to be proved. You can't just postulate that there's an ego that's doing all these things and then assume, using the observations that make you make the postulate, assume that you've proved its existence. You haven't. That's completely circular. I don't know if that makes any sense to you. You can't just assume what needs to be proved. You're confusing postulation with explanation. The ego is not a discrete agent. There are these mental mechanisms going on, but there's no entity doing it. I mean, this is not confined to Eastern traditions. David Hume, the great Scottish skeptical philosopher, said, I look inside myself, I don't see a little person, I just see a stream of thoughts and feelings going on. There isn't a me that's doing it. Okay? So the sense of self is the ego is a set of feelings, ideas, beliefs, images, a felt sense. The illusion is, I think, to think it's an entity that's absolutely real. It exists in the sense that it's an image. Okay? It's not an illusion to say it exists as a representation in consciousness. So I would think of it that way. Well, you don't have to reject your ego. You don't have to say it's a bad thing. We have to live in the world and participate, and you need everyday ego functions to participate in the world, clearly. And the ego has its place. The ego is important for everyday survival. It has a certain place. The problem comes when you think the ego is all that there is. You don't realize that the ego is a part of the totality. You don't realize, you think that the ego is separate from every other ego. And because of the ego's fear and vulnerability, it makes it aggressive and violent. That's the difficulty with it. So it has a certain sensible place. A working mind is very important for everyday reality. This is what Jung, I think, what one could say that Jung means when he says relativize the ego. The ego is in relation, it's relative to this larger consciousness. Somewhere he says that we eventually we realize that we are, the ego is the object of a superordinate subject. In other words, that's a complicated way of something is conscious of you. There is something, some totality which is conscious of you. And one realizes that. That's what he means by relativizing the ego and not thinking it's absolute. Okay? It's not a solid entity. All right. Now, because the ego is made up of all this conditioning, because it's made up of its story, all its memory, all its knowledge, all its accumulated emotions, we are all that. That's what we are. But all that is from the past. All that has already happened to us. All that is stored in the brain. So the ego is the past. The ego is the past. We were talking the other day at lunch or dinner about what I think is the fallacious notion of being in the now. You know all that business about being in the now. It's deeply misleading. The ego is never in the now. The ego cannot be in the now. The totality is in the now. But time, the whole notion of now and time is an egoic concept. When we try and be, if I the me starts to try and be in the now. I'm looking at the ego is the past, which is the lens that I look at experience through which I look at experience. Does that make any sense to you? I'm looking at experience through the lens of my I. I'm looking at it through the lens of my of the past, which is the me that's all with all this accumulation. So I, me, the ego, can never be in the now. That is really quite deeply misleading. See, what science does is it makes things disappear when you look into things. You think this is a solid piece of wood, and then science comes along with its electron microscope and whatnot, and this thing starts to disappear into atoms and molecules and energy. Okay, whenever science starts to look into things, look into the body and it becomes organs and then cells and so on, and biochemical processes. When science starts to look into things, things start to disappear. Well, the ego is like that. I'm trying to make the point that when we look into the nature of the ego, it starts to disappear. It's not a thing. Okay, I'm trying to do a kind of science here. I don't reject it. I think the empirical personality is part of the totality. I mean, that which is decided it wants to have empirical personalities. So who am I to argue with it? They're interesting, they're fascinating, they have their own flavor. There's billions of flavors, okay? So I don't reject it. I just think we have to get its relative importance quite clear, okay? So your likes and dislikes will continue, your preferences will continue, but your relationship to them will change. You will say, this feeling is arising, this preference is arising. You don't have to say, I am feeling this way, or I am having this preference. Actions will arise. You see, if there's no little man or woman in the head with a steering wheel, it's rather like, you know that ride at Disney World or Disneyland? There's one of the rides where you get in a boat and it takes you down this tunnel on this river. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? You sit in this boat and it takes you down a river, and there's a steering wheel, and you turn the wheel, and sometimes the boat goes the way you turn the wheel, and sometimes you turn the wheel one way and the boat goes the other way. Well, that's the ego. Okay. You try desperately to turn the boat this way, and life takes it the other way. For the simple reason that there is no you in charge of things. The ego is not an agent in the sense that's a separate me doing things. What's happening is that the totality is doing things, the big T totality, and it's expressing itself in what is. So and it doesn't matter whether the ego likes it or dislikes it, or it's painful or egoic or evil or all that kind of thing. That is all part of the totality, okay? Which doesn't mean that at the level of the ego that action will not arise. You see, this is not a recipe for passivity. When something needs to be done, the action that's necessary arises because we know what to do. I was using the example again the other day at dinner or something. I had so many conversations, I can't remember with who, when, sorry. If you see a child about to run into the road, you don't stop and think about what to do. If you see a blind man about to walk off a cliff, you don't stop and think about what to do. The right action just arises. But it arises because the perception is so clear. So this doesn't mean that no action will arise, that we can just sit back and nothing will happen. The self knows what to do when a child is about to run into the road. You don't have to worry. The right action just arises. Now, the problem is that many situations are not as clear as that. But if you see a poisonous snake on the road, to use another image of Krishnamurti, he says, if you see a poisonous snake on the road, you don't have to think about what to do. You know what to do because your life is at stake. You avoid it. So a lot of what to do is a matter of seeing the situation clearly enough. I'll talk a little bit more about that maybe later on when I talk about the problem of suffering, if I can get to that. Because this leads to a certain attitude towards suffering. I want to say a little bit about the brain. The ego is dependent on the functions of an intact brain. Now, this is not to say that consciousness is dependent on the brain. I'm going to come to that in a minute. I don't think that consciousness is dependent on the brain, but what we call the ego is dependent on the brain, because we know that from people who are brain damaged, the egos don't work as well. Now, the brain is the result of several million years of evolution, all right? And all human beings essentially have the same brain structure. The brain is full of different contents because we've got different memories, but the structure is the same in everyone. And we have the same brain structurally and physiologically, anatomically, that our early hominid ancestors did 150,000 years ago. So what's the difference between us and them? We speak different languages, we have different skin color, we dress differently, but essentially we're the same. There's really no difference, in the sense that we all experience the same grief, the same sorrow, the same joy, the same pleasure, the same fear of survival, the same worries. I mean, the reasons for these things are different in all of us, but our experience of sorrow and grief and joy is the same. That's why Krishnamurti is able to say, you are the world. Because our experience, all these important experiences are the same for all of us. We just get there for different reasons. But once we're there, the experience is the same. Now, if we don't see this essential sameness, if we don't see that all human beings are the same in these ways, that we all have these same important feelings and so on, then we start to build barriers around us. We think that ours is better than, you know, my God image is better than your God image. We know what that leads to, okay? So then if we build barriers, we live in our castles because we're afraid, and castles have very thick walls. And how do we cope with our fear? Well, we have power and prestige, and we hope that the castle wall won't be breached. But there's really no reason to have power over other people except fear. Why else would you want power over other people other than fear? It's fear, which is an ego function, as I've tried to describe, which prevents us seeing the reality of our connectedness, and fear which produces aggression. All right, so that's enough about the ego. I just want to also add that, of course, the ego is a lot of our conditioning. A lot of the conditioning that goes on here is produced by factors in the unconscious, repressed material from the unconscious. So we're conditioned by all of that as well. I think I'm going to leave the ego for a minute and talk about this business of consciousness. I'm talking about this unitary level of consciousness. So what can we say about consciousness? We don't have an adequate theory of consciousness. There are people who say, well, consciousness is just a secretion of the brain. Your stomach makes acid, your kidneys make urine, your liver makes bile, and so on, and your brain secretes mind, or your brain secretes consciousness. It's as if you had a big bowl of spaghetti, and then the spaghetti would be the brain, and the steam which is coming off would be the mind. It's what's what they call an epiphenomenon in this way of thinking. Epi, above. It's like an epiphenomenon. I don't know if I've spelled that. Something like that. It's like if you've been at the ocean and you see froth on the waves, that white froth on the surface of the waves, that froth is an epiphenomenon of the waves. Wouldn't be there without the waves. So these materialist thinkers think that consciousness is made by the brain. It's an epiphenomenon of the brain. Well, I don't think that's true, and I'll tell you why I don't think it's true. I think in fact, that I'm going to try and make the case for the fact that consciousness is the common ocean of which we are, as it were, individual molecules or something like that. Well, first of all, there are many kinds of human experiences that couldn't possibly be explained if consciousness was a secretion of the brain. First of all, synchronicity, which I'll talk about if we get to, where some event in the outside world corresponds to some psychological predisposition, indicating that the inner and the outer actually are a unitary reality. But then there was what we call psychic experiences, telepathy, precognition, knowing in advance what's going to happen, precognitive dreams, you dream of a death or a plane crash and it happens the next day, perception beyond the range of ordinary senses. Swedenborg is somewhere else and suddenly he knows that there's a fire in Stockholm, that kind of thing. Clairvoyance, okay, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. The reality of these kind of experiences is debated endlessly. I'm convinced by the evidence for them. I think that they really exist. If these things really exist, none of that could be explained by brain-based consciousness. It wouldn't make any sense. They would only make sense if it's true to say that we are actually immersed in a field of consciousness. So in this room, there is this larger field of consciousness with a capital C. In which case, it might be more accurate to say that rather than consciousness being generated by the brain, the brain is like an antenna or a receiver. The reason that perhaps the reason that the brain is so convoluted and folded, you know how it looks, is that it's like someone has taken a very long antenna and crammed it into a very small spherical shape. So then what the brain does is pick up consciousness, receive, like a radio set picking up a signal. Okay. What? We're all getting it. It's just that the rest of the set is not working very well. Well, and the ego is always interfering. I mean, if I had a candle here, I've used this metaphor before. I think, I don't know if it was here. If I had a candle here, the candle flame wouldn't be very impressive until I turned off all these lights. Then it would be impressive. So the ego is like all these lights, and if you like, the spirit is like the candle. We're so dazzled by the ego that we don't pay attention to the light of the spirit sometimes, but it's there all the time. I'm sorry these metaphors are so crude. I can't do any better, really. I think that these kind of experiences are real. In a dream, we see what's going to happen to the next day, or we dream of a loved one who is far away. All right, we try to affect people's recovery through prayer, and somehow it happens. How the heck could these things happen unless consciousness was completely was the field that we're all immersed in? These events don't fit the boundaries of conventional science, and they drive materialistic scientists crazy. Because you know that it's a challenge to their narcissism, because they don't really understand them. So that's the evidence from consciousness, which for me is convincing. I don't know whether it is for you or not. What about the evidence from quantum physics of our deep interconnectedness? Now, I don't really understand quantum physics, and so what I'm telling you is secondhand from talking to a couple of friends I have who are quantum physicists and trying to understand what they're talking about. What they tell me is that as a result of quantum physics, our assumptions about the basic nature of reality have to be revised. The reality is not what we've thought it was. It's not described by ordinary Newtonian physics that we got in high school. Now, the aspect that I'm going to talk about is what they call non-locality. That's spelt as one word, N-O-N, locality, non-locality. The common sense notion is that objects are isolated in space. Objects are separate from each other. Non-locality is the teaching that objects that appear to be separate are actually connected in ways that transcend time and space. It was described by a physicist called John Bell, B-E-L-L, who showed that a pair of particles that are quantum connected remain connected no matter how far apart they are. And when one changes, the other changes instantaneously, with no time interval for information to pass from one to the other. So if the spin on one particle changes, or the momentum, the spin on the other particle changes, and there isn't time to get a message from one to the other saying, I'm about to change my spin. They're not even going at the speed of light. They change instantaneously. So the idea is that individual phenomena seem local, but actually there's a deep quantum connectedness beneath the surface, a kind of invisible quantum connectedness between everything. And that influence is unmediated, and it's immediate. So there is a domain of wholeness which is outside of time and space that links everything. So you can imagine this kind of field of quantum connectedness and objects and people arising kind of like icebergs emerging out of the ocean, out of this field of quantum connectedness. But there is this field of connectedness at a deep level of reality. So to suggest that we are connected through a deep level of consciousness is just to agree with modern developments in quantum physics. I've got to finish at 1:45. I'm not sure what to talk about next. Take a stretch. Let's talk about that. I apparently didn't make it clear enough that when I was asking what is our true nature or our essence, if it's not the body and not the ego, the answer is this consciousness, it's this awareness. That's what I meant to say and didn't say. It's amazing how much you can say and not say what you meant to say. Yes.
So what about God?
What about God?
Is God part of this?
No. You haven't got it yet. God is this. There is in the non-dual teaching, there is nothing that's not God. There is nothing that's not God. Everything is God. So God is not part of this, and you are not part of God. You are that. That's why the Upanishad says, thou art that. You're not a part of it. You're an expression of it. Okay? Are there some more questions, or is this all crystal clear? Yeah. Oh wait, we need a microphone. Sorry. How did I do that?
Because there we sit together.
Yeah.
Silent, centered.
Oh, yeah.
Down into the all.
Mm-hmm.
Cross out the word down.
I see you've got it. I sound like Professor, what's his name? Higgins.
But I think we practice this.
Yeah.
When we're honest with ourselves. And thank you very, very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's not my pleasure, it's a pleasure. See, there is a practice. Can I take a minute before I do another question? Okay. There is a practice, and it is a practice, which is that one simply pays attention to what arises in the body and mind. Okay? And the body is terribly important. Whatever the source with a capital S is, I mean, this is kind of a silly thing to say, but whatever it is the body, and it is felt in the body by an ego as the energy of the body. So one can, if I'm in this traffic jam, and I try this, I'm not suggesting, if I could do this all the time, I'd be the Buddha, you know, so I can't do this. What happens is that one does it and then forgets to do it and does it again, and you know, it's like any spiritual practice. You forget it and then you pick up the pieces and do it again. But the practice is to simply be aware of the energy in the body. So you sit in the traffic jam, and instead of cursing fate, you go into the body. Pay attention to the energy in the body, and you'll feel it as warmth or tingling, you know, heat, movement. It's always there, and know that that is the spiritual source in the body. As the body. In is wrong because in is dual. As the body. So, and if you know that energy that you're feeling is the source, the traffic jam becomes rather less important. Okay. And you can just stay there. It's very peaceful. So whatever activity you're doing, you can always take a moment to check in with the body and know that that is the source in the body. It's always chi or prana, you know, they have names for it. But that's, names are absurd. This doesn't have name. You could call it energy if you want. As I said, you know, you could call it Albert. It doesn't matter what you call it. You just give it a name, but it obviously doesn't have a name. That's why the best thing is to call it that which is, or something like that, or that, or something. I like that. I mean, the simplest Sanskrit mantra is Om Tat Sat. Tat means that, and Sat means is. That is. That is. Just imagine capital T, that is. That is. Where you can see what that means, right? That is. You can say it in Sanskrit, tat, tat sat, tat sat. That's all, that's the simplest mantra. There's nothing else to say, that is. So, and then you can watch the mind. You can watch images and thoughts and feelings arise in the mind. And the value of doing that is that you have a little distance. You realize that that's arising in the ego, and that what is watching, that's the point. The awareness which is doing the watching is the knower, the experience. It's the final witness. The witness, capital W, is that which is aware of what is arising. It's the tape which is aware of the music recorded on it. Does this make any kind of sense at all? So simply watch the music arise and know that you are actually the tape, or you are the knower or the witness. And don't have to worry, there's no infinite regress. There's no witness of the witness of the witness, because the final witness is the witness. There's just the witness consciousness, which is aware of the arising and falling of thoughts and feelings. I mean, this is not new, is it? But it's a practice. You don't have to go to India or an ashram, or you don't have to do all that stuff. You don't, I mean, you know, I like incense myself, but it's not necessary. Sorry, let me go back to the questions.
Yes, you had mentioned about this. It's about the power of narrative.
It may not be turned on.
Okay.
Yes, better.
I know that words get in the way,
yeah.
And but this concept of being in the now is really important to me as far as surviving. And this idea of ego, I agree with you. It's either in the past or in the future in terms of concern.
Or it could be in the future, yeah.
Right. So